The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. This week...
My job is not to be a cheerleader for the executive branch. Yeah. My job is to stand up for the rights of the House of Commons. And the Speaker will assuredly do so.
Happy New Year. Now, where were we? The odds of Theresa May's withdrawal agreement getting through Parliament aren't looking much better than they were before Christmas, and Britain looks set to sail into what May warns is uncharted territory. With just 78 days and counting till we leave the European Union, and with neither an exit deal anyone likes, or sufficient preparations if we crash out, Parliament is readying the lifeboats. We look at what happens if and when May's deal hits the rocks next week. Also this week, we talk to Labour's Harriet Harman about what can be done to stop MPs being harassed. And we take a look at the future of the NHS with The Guardian's health policy editor, Dennis Campbell. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, if Theresa May expected MPs to reflect on her withdrawal agreement deal over the Christmas break and come back in a more receptive mood, she couldn't have been more wrong. Battle resumed in earnest this week as MPs, with the help of the Speaker John Bercow, voted to take back control of the Brexit process. First, a coalition of Labour and Conservative MPs, led by Yvette Cooper, organised an amendment to the finance bill to curb the government's tax-raising powers in the event of no deal. Then May was defeated again over another amendment, this one forcing her to present MPs with a new Brexit plan within 3 days rather than 21 if she loses the vote next Tuesday. The rebels may have won the battle, but will they win the war? And is there any Brexit plan that could win a majority? Well, I'm joined to discuss all this by my expert panel, The Guardian's Jonathan Friedland and Dawn Foster, and Will Tanner, former advisor to Theresa May and director of the think tank Onward. Jonathan, is this the week that Parliament took back control?
It looks like that, doesn't it, with a little help from Speaker Bercow. You had those, and I think you're referring to those couple of amendments or Commons motions that were put firstly by Yvette Cooper and another group of backed by sort of Tory rebels to say the government can't go ahead with no deal without being impeded, at least in quite a technical way, about tax raising. And then the Grieve amendment, as these phrases are all going to be remembered. They sound like sort of Robert Ludlum thrillers from the 70s.
The Grieve amendment.
The Grieve memorandum, the Grieve amendment. That require the government to come back with a new plan if the other one falls. You know, these in fascinating scenes after PMQs. I was in the chamber on Wednesday, and it was just, it's now becoming a sort of ritual where PMQs is actually quite dull. And then when that finishes, it all kicks off with people starting to challenge the figure of the Speaker. And it happened just before Christmas about the claim that he had in the past described Andrea Leadsom as a stupid woman. And then this time it was about the decision he had made. But look, on its face, it looks like the Speaker decided to say, I'm going to give MPs the power to check the executive. People who don't like it say that was a departure from, you know, centuries of procedure. But it's interesting how so many of the leavers who in the 2016 campaign and before used to say, we want to do this not just for petty things about the pound in your pocket, but for a profound principle in this mother of parliaments, this ancient kingdom, that, you know, Parliament must be supreme, Parliament must be sovereign. And then when it exercises sovereignty, suddenly they're on their feet with lots of points of order saying, no, it's not meant to be like this. Today, we want the government to be in control. So, I think Parliament is now back in the driving seat. I don't think it's necessarily some huge constitutional shift. It is partly the quirk of 2017.
It's a hung parliament.
Yeah. And, you know, if Theresa May had kept a majority, I don't think we'd be seeing any of this. I don't think it would be possible. But instead, the perfect storm of hung parliament and this massive issue and the weird mismatch of representative democracy, parliament, and a verdict of direct democracy, the referendum, means that we have suddenly this rare coincidence of circumstances, which, yes, means Parliament is sort of sovereign once again, back in the driving seat.
Mm. And well, it is part of the problem, part of the reason we've ended up here, that Theresa May didn't adapt and adjust her Brexit plan to the result of that 2017 general election. She went into that general election saying, give me a mandate to negotiate this kind of deal that I want. She didn't really get that mandate, but nothing really changed, did it?
Well, I think you're right that Theresa May effectively kept on with the deal that she thought was the right deal for the country. It's clear that she has always thought that that deal is the right deal for the country. And we now have a deal agreed with the European Union that she's trying to implement, albeit struggling to do so through Parliament at the moment. I do think, I agree with Jonathan, I think that what we're seeing is a pure function of parliamentary arithmetic. This is a function of the hung parliament last year. It is the inability of the government to bring together enough of a coalition of MPs on their own side and possibly from other parties to back the deal. But what we're really seeing is a parliament unable to choose too. Like, we talk about parliament taking back control, but if parliament wants to deliver Brexit as we continue hearing from backbenchers, then, I mean, to govern is to choose. They need to decide what type of Brexit they want. And the kind of the current process is effectively Brexit by process of elimination. It's basically ruling out again like different scenarios until we get to the lowest common denominator. And personally, I think that's the worst possible outcome. It doesn't lead, it doesn't show the people that we're trying to deliver on their votes, their opinions, their wants and needs. And it gets embroiled in a really difficult Westminster bubble focused, process driven story, rather than trying to focus on the outcome we're trying to achieve. Like, no one's really talking about the end state we want now. Everyone's focusing on the next parliamentary amendment, the next bit of arcane kind of nomenclature in parliament, rather than what we're trying to deliver. And I think that's a great shame. And I think ordinary people will be pretty disappointed by our politics right now.
Dawn, do you think that's right? It's part of the problem that we don't really know what kind of Brexit MPs want or what kind of Brexit there could be a majority for.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that at this point, obviously, we don't know what's going to happen going forward immediately after any form of withdrawal. But also, there isn't anything on the table that everybody is happy with. And when you look at the parliamentary arithmetic, there's no way that Theresa May can get this through. She put forward a document yesterday for, you know, designed to try and calm the DUP down and bring them on side. And there was nothing in there that could help bring them on side whatsoever. You know, it said that it would give Stormont some powers to veto things, and that's completely pointless because Stormont hasn't sat for for exactly 2 years now. So, you know, I mean, we'll talk briefly about kind of ordinary people. I think the vast majority of people aren't paying attention to what John Bercow is doing in Parliament. They aren't paying attention to a lot of the kind of machinations of the Conservative Party. They just want everybody to, you know, to use an overused phrase, get on with it at this point. But, you know, I feel like at this point, everybody is completely bogged down in kind of parliamentary process and isn't looking at the kind of longer term picture, which is, you know, a big problem. And I think it's turning off voters a lot. So whenever I speak to people in, you know, I went to Wales and kind of Northern Ireland recently, Wales are very Leave, Northern Ireland are very Remain. And the main thing I got from everybody I was speaking to was that they were just completely fed up of talking about it. And even those people who had voted Remain just wanted out just to get on with it.
And that underlines the potential problem with some of the options that Theresa May might have, doesn't it? So next Tuesday, we fully expected to lose this vote. Even, I think, you know, most ministers will admit to you and they think they're going to lose it. She then faces some very acute challenges, Johnny, doesn't she? And you know, one thing she could do is come back and say, let's put this to the people. But that would be a very risky endeavour, wouldn't it? Given that, as you say, as Dawn says, they're rather fed up with all this.
Yeah, I think where I sort of see it at the moment is that, you know, the ship of state is sailing towards this big iceberg called No Deal, and that everybody is, not everybody, but most people are pretty scared of that prospect. And so now there's this odd sort of competition for which lifeboat are we going to jump into. There's the Theresa May wants it to be her lifeboat, her deal. And so she's saying, I know you don't like No Deal. And she kept on saying this, particularly to Jeremy Corbyn across the dispatch box at Prime Minister's Questions. You keep saying you don't want No Deal. Well, vote for my deal then. So she wants that to be the refuge that people go to. There's the other group that want it to be Norway Plus, you know, and that's gaining some traction. And there's some reporting, including in our own paper, that says John McDonnell has been talking to the Norway Plus people, and, you know, and some Norway Plus people themselves are saying McDonnell's sort of signalling to them that he's on side for that. So that would be one scenario, and that has at least the appeal. It speaks to what Dawn and Will were saying, which is it's then over. At least you can say you've done it. Actually, it wouldn't be over. We'd be into a whole lots of talks, but you could say we've crossed that Brexit Rubicon. And then the other lifeboat is a people's vote, is a referendum. And you've just got to think two things, I think. The first is which of those lifeboats will be least unpalatable to Theresa May and to Jeremy Corbyn and to all the other big players. But the other one is, you know, this assumption that she, Theresa May, will not let the ship bang into that iceberg. And I'm just, These days, I don't think anything for granted. I mean, people, you know, one MP I spoke to said yesterday, I just don't believe, you know, a vicar's daughter could take the country into such a catastrophe. And I just thought that is not a good enough basis on which to rely on the next sort of steps. Does this belief that she's somehow got this sense of duty because she's the, you know, born into the cloth kind of thing? I just don't buy that. So I worry that this assumption everyone has that, you know, in the end we'll all recoil from the iceberg, we won't let ourselves crash into no deal. I just hope that's a sure assumption. It might not be.
Will, you've worked closely with Theresa May. What do you think she'll do when that Tuesday night vote is lost? Will she come out and say, a cabinet minister said that to me this week, I think she'll come out and say, let's do no deal.
So I don't know, and I think the last 2 years have shown
none of us know.
Predictions are a mug's game. And I think it will depend on the scale of the defeat, the type of people who voted against, if indeed it is defeated. But I think that probably is the most likely scenario. My personal view, and I've said this before, is that I think Parliament is rapidly approaching a decision point where it either decides to go for no deal or it decides to dilute the referendum result in some major form, possibly by delaying Brexit or possibly by effectively saying that we're not going to have Brexit. And I would include a second referendum in the latter of those two options. Because everything else, second referendum isn't really an outcome, it's part of the process. It's the process to potentially 2 more years of chaos. So I don't think that is a lifeboat, to use Jonathan's analogy, that people should readily cling to. I personally think no deal is very much underpriced within the Westminster kind of world. I think people aren't talking about it enough. And I think some of the amendments this week have not only made no deal a bit more likely, but they've made the risk of a very difficult and hard no deal much more likely, because they've effectively tied the hands of government to prepare for that effectively.
And why do they make it more likely, do you think?
Well, because I think they have effectively further limited the government's manoeuvring space by kind of ever boxing in the Prime Minister and Number 10 into where they want the Prime Minister to go, and where she is currently pretty unwilling to go. She reduces the ability for her to box and cox and actually and kind of be a bit more flexible in negotiations with the EU itself and with negotiations with her own party. And I really worry about potentially well-intentioned backbenchers doing things in concert with one another across party, but actually making it more difficult for the executive to get the outcome that everyone wants, which is to avoid no deal.
And when you talked about not obeying the referendum result, diluting the referendum result there, do you think a Norway-style deal of the kind that Johnny was talking about would dilute the referendum result? Do you think that's, because that's certainly what the Prime Minister thinks, isn't it? That wasn't what people think they voted for.
Unless it included some quite significant concessions from the EEA around migration alongside the traditional Norway model, then I think that would be a dilution of Brexit, yes.
Dawn, Labour's got some quite big decisions to take in the next week or so, hasn't it? And there's been a lot of kind of delaying the big decisions. Fair enough, it's the government that's in the driving seat that's been doing the negotiations and so on. But for example, you know, if Theresa May comes out next week and says, you know, I'm going for no deal, I'm going for a second referendum, or I'm going for whatever else, Labour's going to have to decide very, very quickly, you know, what it goes for, which bunch of backbenchers it allies with, what it does next. What's the thinking about this?
I think at this point, Labour have, you know, they are being very, very careful about how they move, and a lot of it is very, very tactical. Also, obviously, a lot of it is down to the fact that Labour's decision-making comes through party conference each year. So they have this quite complex fudge about Brexit, whereby they respect the referendum decision, but argue that they could possibly move it in a different way. So obviously for Labour, they would prefer a general election rather than a second referendum, but aren't entirely ruling out a second referendum at this point. So there is a lot of that in play, and I think that Labour have to be very careful, and they are being very careful at the moment in trying not to show their hand too early, purely because then Theresa May, etc., will try and outmanoeuvre them. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens when the DUP move. I mean, Will mentioned that nobody wants no deal, which I don't think is true. I think quite a lot of backbenchers do want no deal. I followed Nigel Dodds and quite a few members of the DUP around London, and they've been speaking to a lot of kind of hard Brexiters and saying that they believe no deal would be really good. We just moved to World Trade Organization rules, and they seem very, very keen on that. So it'll be interesting to see if the DUP actually show their hand before the vote. If they do, would Labour then speak to them in concert with the SNP about possibly getting a no confidence vote in the government? That would be interesting to see. But they will have to decide at that point if they are willing to jump into bed, even on one small decision with the DUP. But yeah, I do think at the moment it does involve some very, very kind of fast decision making and trying not to show their hand too early before Theresa May, you know, tries to kind of outmanoeuvre them.
Because if they table that vote of no confidence next week in the immediate aftermath of the meaningful vote and they then lose it, then you'll see a process where, you know, Theresa May comes back with a statement. Loads of MPs will then amend that statement to say we want a second referendum or we want X, Y or Z, and Labour's going to have to decide which of those it backs. I mean, there's no chance to go back to conference, is there?
No, I mean, until now, and it's worked in some ways quite well, this so-called constructive ambiguity, strategic ambiguity, just sitting on that fence between Remain and Leave. And I think in this speech that Jeremy Corbyn is due to give as we sit down talking now, there's still more of that, you know, a little bit for Remain, a little bit for Leave. People like me keep saying, oh, the moment is coming soon where they're going to have to get off that fence. And yet, actually, they managed to keep it going for longer. I think the reason why things that moment might now this time be coming is simply because inside, it's just based on what people tell me, the notion of being a midwife to an enabler of no deal is now seen as not neutral for Labour. It's damaging for Labour among their own people. In other words, until now, the policy has been, look, let the Tories suffer all the fallout from this, let them be blamed with it, and we can just, you know, watch it happen. Now I think the feeling is if there was a no deal, that would be, you know, rebound on Labour. It would be their fault that they allowed it to happen, and therefore they've got to do something else. Because remember, and this is the crucial point, it's why I mentioned the sort of keep going back to the iceberg point, that is the default. I know we all know that sitting around here, but I think it needs to constantly be restated. We will crash out with the no deal unless something active happens. It's not enough just to keep saying, passing votes saying we're against no deal. You have to be ultimately for something that stops no deal. And so that does ultimately require a decision. And I think there was a time where Labour could have thought, well, no deal, it'll be her funeral. It won't be us who suffer. I think now the calculation is there will be enough Remain-minded people within the Labour family, Labour voters, who will just be aghast that the Labour opposition allowed that to happen. So they have to come up with something else.
Do you think that's right? Or is this worry about, you can only say for so long, this is a Tory Brexit, this is the Tories' fault, this is Theresa May's responsibility?
In some ways, I think that the only kind of way I kind of differ is that I think at this point, when we come to the vote, obviously Theresa May will lose it because of mathematics and the fact that it's an awful deal. And obviously now she'll have to come back with a different plan. I think Labour are right at this point to continue pushing for another election rather than a second referendum at this point. I think firstly because it's becoming increasingly easier to prove that Theresa May cannot govern. You know, she cannot get anything through. That, you know, she had problems with the finance bill. They've now withdrawn the next phase of universal credit because it was obvious they weren't going to get it through the House. So I think it's a lot easier at this point to say that Theresa May is incapable of governing. The government, you know, the government can't get anything through. They're completely, gridlocked. Therefore, we should move to a general election. I mean, the problem with the second referendum is I honestly think that if it was called, Leave would win with a bigger margin. And whenever I speak to people about the fact that a lot of people are pushing for Labour to adopt that, nobody ever really thinks about what would happen if Labour did push for a second referendum and Leave won with a bigger margin. What would happen to Labour then? What would happen to the country then? We'd probably be in a much worse position, and there'd be even less kind of strategic room for manoeuvre.
Mm. Well, we're talking about general election there. Could Theresa May go for a general election? That's another thing that gets occasionally talked about, isn't it? As a plan B or plan C or whatever.
She's given, and she said this on the Mar programme last week, she's given a very clear assurance to the party that she won't call a snap general election.
I think she did give some of those in 2017.
Yes, we remember them. We still wear the scars of those ones.
Well,
yeah.
I think I wear them too. Yes. I think the party would strongly advise against and I think actively frustrate the idea of going for another general election. I also am relatively sure that the Conservative Party would really struggle to do better at the next general election than it did last time. Really, let's not forget there are 97 seats in the country with a majority of less than 5%, so marginals, and there are 12 seats where Labour is second with a majority of less than 1%. I mean, the ability of the Labour Party to make quite significant gains at the next general election doesn't require anything like a significant swing. It's kind of within the margin of error, and the Conservative Party won more more votes the last general election that it's done since, I think ever and proportionally since the 1980s. So the idea that the Conservative Party could improve on that position at a general election, I think, is for the birds. And the Prime Minister, I don't think, wants a general election personally anyway.
And arguably it might not even resolve the challenge of Brexit, might it? Johnny, you'd end up with a slightly different parliament, but you might still struggle to find a deal that everyone
I don't
could.
Think it would. I mean, that interview that Jeremy Corbyn gave with you before Christmas, where he says, you know, if we won an election, we'd still go ahead with Brexit. Now, obviously, that disappointed a lot of Labour Remainers, but which, as we know from the polling, forms the overwhelming majority. I mean, 87-88% of Labour members. But it also meant that actually the notion of a general election as a clarifying exercise on Brexit is no longer viable, because there have been throughout history elections about specific issues. But for that to work under our mainly two-party system, one party has to be for X and the other party has to be for not X. And if you had the Tories for Brexit and the Labour against Brexit, then a general election would be absolutely clarifying. But if both parties are saying we're both for Brexit, we both want the best deal, we both want to have all the good bits about the EU but none of the bad bits, a general election clarifies nothing. And so that's why when, you know, Richard Bergen and the other people say we want to, you know, to go back and get a better deal, it doesn't sound credible, because we've seen that movie. We know how that works, because there are certain constraints on what the EU can give. And therefore, that won't be clarifying in that way. And that is why people end up in the second referendum, because the hole we're in, the only way out of it, unless there was to be a conversion, the Labour Party to become the anti-Brexit party, and I don't think that's likely. The hole we're in is one we got into through a referendum, and therefore there's a logic to saying the only way we can get out of it. And so that's one of those lifeboats. The other one is to say, and this I think is the argument made by the Norway Plus people, which is, it's true it's not a full-blooded Brexit, but it is a 52-48% type Brexit. It's got quite a lot of leave in it, in the sense we'd be leaving the political structures of the European Union, and quite a lot of remain in it, because we'd still be in the single market and the customs union. Either that is the end sort of compromise, or it just means everyone's disappointed.
OK, thank you all. We'll be paying another visit to Parliament later on.
Today in Focus is a new Guardian podcast that brings you closer to our journalism by getting behind the news every weekday. You'll join me, Anushka Astana, talking to people at the centre of the big stories impacting our world. We'll use personal perspectives and expert analysis to put you at the heart of what matters. Listen to Today in Focus and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you choose to listen.
Now, on Monday, Theresa May visited Alderhay Children's Hospital in Liverpool to unveil her 10-year plan for the NHS and show the government has something to talk about that isn't Brexit. The 136-page plan comes after ministers announced the budget will be increased by £20.5 billion a year by 2023 and aims to see money shifted from hospitals to mental health and the community. But what does it mean for patients? Earlier, I talked to health policy editor for The Guardian and The Observer, Dennis Campbell. Dennis, you were at the launch, weren't you? What's this going to mean for the NHS?
So this is the biggest, most detailed and most ambitious plan for the NHS since the year 2000, since the Tony Blair government drew up a massive NHS plan then. This is, you say, 136 pages, long on promises, long on ambition. For example, a major, major ramping up of preventing us all from becoming unwell in the first place. Guarantees of much better care in hospital and out of hospital to make health outcomes, the treatment we get, the outcomes we achieve in cancer, heart disease, across all the major disease areas, much better. Crucially, it's envisaging a major, major shift in care out of hospital into what's called, in NHS parlance, the community, in or close to people's homes, particularly centred around GP surgeries. NHS leaders have been promising this through previous iterations.
I was going to say, some of that sounds quite familiar, some of those themes. Yeah.
It's a long-standing ambition and pledge of ministers, NHS leaders and NHS plans to do this. The view now is that because visibly the NHS, what they call secondary care, hospital care, is so visibly overburdened, creaking and under pressure, they really, really, really have to do this now as hand in glove with making us, keeping us all healthier for longer at home and out of hospital, because the hospital system can't deal anymore. Therefore, this time they really, really, really have to mean it and really, really get on with it.
And it's a significant sum of money we're talking about, isn't it? And, you know, which had to be sort of wrested from the grip of Philip Hammond. But is it going to be enough to meet the rising needs over the next 10 years?
OK, let's be clear about this. It's clearly a huge sum of money. It's the biggest sum of money in cash terms ever, in proportionate terms, in terms of the annual budget increase since 2009-10. But it's not enough. No one in NHS thinks it's enough. I think probably even government ministers, if you gave them a truth serum, would acknowledge that. It's not enough. There's not enough money there to meet the rich ambition of the plan.
Right. And you know, in which case, at what point does it start to creak? And this is Theresa May wants to see this as part of her domestic legacy. And it's increasingly obvious to patients, isn't it, that the NHS is creaking at the seams.
Yes, the NHS problems are very visible. It's unclear how quickly this will tackle many of the things that people notice. So there are two things that people mainly notice when they kind of interact with and rely on the NHS. First of all, that the staffing isn't anywhere near where it needs to be. And secondly, that more and more people, broadly, more people are waiting longer for more things, whether that's in NE, for cancer care, or for kind of planned operations, and also to see the GP. It's not clear at all how quickly this will solve any of these problems. And the staffing is the number one problem. You had the major organisations representing hospital trusts this week saying on the back of the plan, this is all great, thanks for the money, it's all, you know, a lovely, shiny new plan, but it cannot be delivered unless we solve the fact that the NHS in England alone is short of more than 100,000 staff. There are no easy solutions coming to that. And in some ways, the most important thing to do with the NHS wasn't published this week. It's the fact that the NHS workforce strategy is promised now for sometime later on this year. Good luck with that, because there are no obvious solutions sitting around on the shelf to be picked down, dusted off, and reproduced as policy. It's a very, very, very tough cookie.
And that's potentially a very expensive part of it, isn't it? There's sometimes a sense among politicians, I think, that money spent on staff is almost kind of wastage, or is, you know, it's all gone into pay rises. What a terrible waste! It's something that's sometimes said about the funding boost, the Labour funding boost, but.
I think that everyone in the NHS has been saying now that although attention in recent years has been on kind of the NHS doesn't get enough money, that's in a sense now been kind of solved, or at least part. It's all to do with social care. That's a disaster. Well, yes, it is. But anyone in the NHS, anyone who runs a hospital trust, any kind of senior doctor, senior person will say to you, lack of staff is the number one problem across all of the staff groups, across almost every setting of care now. There aren't enough people to do it. And certainly from what a hospital trust chief executive would say privately, they expect the situation to get worse before it gets any better. We obviously have a complication of Brexit. I personally think the Brexit impact on NHS haven't been slightly overblown, but it's clearly potentially to be significant. The problem for the government, I think, of NHS staffing is that, as the NHS plan says, to solve the staffing problem, we need much more international recruitment, i.e. non-EU recruitment of nurses and doctors and others. But with how does that fit with the government's new sort of 30 grand cap for salary minimum for people who will be in future allowed to come and work here? That would exclude all junior doctors and most nurses.
Dennis Campbell there. And Will, in your new life as a think tanker, you've been looking at another domestic issue this week, university funding and student funding. What are your recommendations?
Yes, well, we've heard over the last two decades, at least since 1999, when Tony Blair pledged that 50% of school leavers should go to university, that higher education will always lead to a higher salary, to better earnings, and it should always be in the interests of school leavers to think about university as a meaningful choice. We've done a big analysis of new government data, which looks at the long-term earnings for individual courses and individual institutions. And what we found is that actually, for up to 25% of students, university does not deliver enough of a graduate earnings premium to justify it on the basis of either for the individual or for the taxpayer, and that around 10% of graduates 10 years after they leave university will have studied courses which mean they're unlikely to be earning over £25,000, which is the point at which they start to pay back their student loans. So we're calling into question the idea that university is always worthwhile and that certain courses should always be funded through a taxpayer-funded loan system.
And is that a function of the fact that, you know, you just expand it and to some extent it just has sort of diminishing returns the more people do it? Or is that something to do with the way the system doesn't work?
I think it's to do with the fact that quite a large number of people go to do courses that have relatively low earnings value. So actually the most populous course in the country, or course, kind of group of courses, is creative arts. And actually 10 years after university, we think that on average, creative arts graduates will be earning less than £23,000 a year. And that's 125,000 students doing creative arts degrees every year. So that's quite a large number of people. Now, clearly creative arts has value, and there are a minority of those courses which actually deliver really quite significant earnings value for people. But the idea that all of those people are going to go into high earning jobs after they leave university just, I think, simply isn't true. And we just need to be, I think, a bit more honest with people leaving school about what type of earnings future they're going to get from their investment in university, or indeed the taxpayers' investment in university.
So who isn't being honest with them? Because you mentioned in the press release that you said people were mis-selling the concept of degrees. So who precisely isn't being honest with people?
So I think actually the greatest charge should be laid at the door of politicians over the last 20 years. And this is partly because we didn't have the data yet, but it was also this kind of slightly lazy assumption, I think, that higher education was always going to add significant value to people's earnings. I don't think that was always a given. And we now know that not to be true. So politicians should revise the system. The government's reviewing this at the moment. The other thing I would say is that there are universities who market their courses specifically on the basis of their earnings. And we actually found that a number of institutions had very low earnings, yet marketed themselves to students as a big boost to their careers. So I think there is a question about the university system as a whole as well.
I mean, this small thing happened when I was at university called the global financial crash, which I don't think helped particularly. So, I mean, how much of it is actually the economy, and how much of it is, you know, the fact that we should stop more people going to university? And isn't there a worry that the kind of people that we stop going to university are the kind of people who have traditionally been involved in widening participation, people who wouldn't normally have had access to higher education?
I don't think so. So actually, clearly, like, graduate earnings are impacted by wider economic trends. But this is long-term data that the government itself has published. It's publishing its own statistics in 2 months' time, which will give that lifetime's earning figure. So we'll be able to compare our figures to what the government thinks. But when you're talking about £55,000 worth of taxpayers' money as an investment into someone's education through a loan system that is expected to be paid back, and 83% of student loans aren't being paid back, you have to call into question whether or not that system is genuinely working for either those individuals who are earning less money than we expect them to, or for the taxpayer who's ending up having to pay for it. I don't think that should be a controversial thing to say. And I think universities themselves should be quite self-critical about this, because yes, they're there for wider social and cultural value, but they're also there to prepare people for the workforce in order to generate like a better quality of life and earnings potential for those students. Like that's within a university's remit, and that's not a controversial thing to say.
But the remedy for this, I suppose, would, just following the logic of what you said, the remedy would be for fewer people to go to university. And I just don't know what the mechanism for that is, except I suppose just making it harder to get in. The grade requirement goes up and up and up. It seems to me it's pretty high already with the requirement that is set to A-level students to get into even universities that would have been regarded as middle ranking before are demanding 3 A's and or higher. But I mean, is there a way out of this other than that just make university much harder and to go back to the days when it was 7 or 8% only who went to university?
We argue that actually it shouldn't just be about less people going to university, full stop. It should be less people going to university to do specific low value courses. Now they should be going to do
financial value.
Yes, indeed. But they should be going to university, and we should be encouraging more people to go to university to do higher value courses, and diverting people into courses that we know deliver long term earning potential for those students. Or we should be encouraging them to do those courses in other ways. So degree apprenticeships, this government introduced a few years ago, they deliver a higher wage premium than a number of these courses, and people don't take out a big student loan to do those things, and they earn while they're doing them. Now, actually, increasing numbers of people are doing that, and they're finding that is a more beneficial way of getting into the labour market than going to university. We should be encouraging the technical education system too. This isn't about stopping people from going to university, full stop. It's about making sure that when they do, they get the most value out of it.
I feel like there's a whole broader discussion about whether you can, how you measure the value of an education, which we could probably go off on a digression of about at least half an hour. But Johnny, we're in a situation more generally, aren't we, where domestic policy is being dramatically crowded out. It's almost impossible to get anything else done at the moment, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, I wrote something this week saying that, you know, we're all mocking Donald Trump and his shutdown in America over the wall. And yet, in a way, we are in a form of shutdown here where the government is pretty paralysed. And you hear this from the two groups that, you know, that I think you would listen to most seriously would be, yes, leaders in business, but also local government leaders who just say they cannot get a decision, they cannot get a meeting out of Whitehall because people say we're just all tied up with Brexit. And, you know, these are big infrastructural decisions that people have been waiting for. That's true in business, and as I say, and true in local government. It is all Brexit all the time. That, you know, the phrase that was used a lot in the, probably dates me a little bit, we're talking about bandwidth, and, you know, there would be this notion that bandwidth is, we can walk and chew gum at the same time, we can do both. Something like this, you know, which even Dominic Cummings, the man on many of our minds this week after he was, you know, immortalised by Benedict Cumberbatch this week, Dominic Cummings said, who was for this idea of Brexit, that this will be the biggest challenge for the British state since the defeating the Nazis. And so to ask the Whitehall bureaucracy to do that, to take on that task of Brexit and anything else at the same time, has proved to be impossible. And so the result is that we are in a kind of state of paralysis where the government cannot really do anything else except Brexit. So it isn't a formal shutdown like it is in America, where people are literally, national parks are closed and bolted and wages are not being paid. But the effect of the inertia to the point of paralysis, I think, is similar.
Right, thank you all. Now, more than 100 MPs have called on police to improve their response to abusive protesters outside Parliament after Tory MP and Remainer Anna Soubry was taunted with shouts of Nazi this week and harassed as she tried to enter the Palace of Westminster. Speaker John Bercow described the abuse of MPs as a type of fascism and called for a change of policing policy. Labour's Harriet Harman wants to go further and convene a speaker's conference to discuss the issue. Peter Walker asked her why.
Well, I think that everybody strongly supports the right to protest, the right to demonstrate freedom of speech. It absolutely underpins our democracy, and I think all MPs strongly believe in that and are champions of it. But the question is whether or not the assaults, threats, intimidation and harassment of MPs has actually moved beyond a line to where we really need to consider whether the balance between the rights of protesters and the ability of MPs to get on with their job, which they've been elected to by their voters, whether or not the balance is in the wrong place now. And I think that we all saw on television what happened to Anna Soubry, with people shouting and ranting in her face, blocking her way. I think people felt that stepped over the line, but rather than simply just blaming the individual police officers who stood by, there needs to be a proper deliberation of where does the balance lie between MPs being able to get on and do their job safely, but also ensure we accommodate the right to protest.
And you've been thinking about this obviously quite a long time before these incidents took place in the last few days and weeks. And you've put together a list of a lot of the kind of threats or the harassment that MPs have faced over the last few years. And it's quite a chilling list, isn't it?
Well, it is, but I'm afraid it's just the tip of the iceberg. I think that there is a major problem of MPs not reporting what's happening to them, because as MPs, we want to be standing up for our constituents. We want to be champions of the areas that we represent, not victims of events which are outside our control. So therefore, MPs tend to just grin and bear it and try and just get on with their work, just try and tough it out. But I think that it's not sensible to get to let levels of threat and abuse and even violence continue without we step back and say, right, what do the police need to do about this? What do the Crown Prosecution Service need to do about this? What do the House authorities in terms of security need to be doing about it? Because one of the things that's at stake here is not just the importance of MPs being able to vote how they see right to vote and being able to say what they believe, you know, loudly and controversially if necessary. It's also about MPs' engagement with the public, because we don't want a situation where they have in many other countries where MPs won't go on public transport. They're always in limos sweeping by, that they won't just walk down the street and bump into people. That's one of the great benefits of our system, that MPs are out and about in their constituency, in public places. We don't want them to retreat, and we don't want them to have to change their surgery arrangements because they feel threatened.
And in terms of the format of this, could you explain what a speakers' conference is and what kind of format it would take?
Well, the reason why it's a speakers' conference, why we're asking for a speakers' conference rather than asking for the government to do something, is that this is not the responsibility of the government. This is a problem of Parliament, and therefore Parliament needs to step forward and sort it out. And of course, the head of Parliament is the Speaker. And the process of a speakers' conference, it's a bit like a select committee in that it will have members of all parties on it, it will sit in public, it will be able to hear evidence, it will collect data, it will make recommendations. So really it's for the Speaker to establish it, but the Speaker will want to be confident that there is support across the House for this. And next Wednesday on the Joint Committee on Human Rights, which I chair, we're going to see the senior backbench figures from each of the parties, together with Maria Miller, the chair of the Women and Equality Select Committee, to ask them whether they feel that we really should have a speakers' conference now. And then that would provide the mandate for the Speaker to set up the speakers' conference. And then there would be a resolution passed by the House which would set out the terms of reference and the timescale.
Harriet Harman talking to our Peter Walker there. Dawn, it wasn't just MPs being shouted at and attacked, was it? It was also journalists, including our own Owen Jones. Is this a policing issue? And you,
yep.
I'm sorry. Is this a policing issue? What's the answer to it?
I think in some ways it is, yes. I think one of the things that surprised me was that there was so much focus on exactly what happened outside Westminster when the group in question... on Monday, it was about 20 men shouted at me, UK Burley and Anna Soubry. And when I filmed them, showed it to a few friends, quite a few of them pointed out that they were copying a lot of the tactics of the American alt-right. So essentially, they would, use these aggressive tactics, use Facebook Live to film them. So when they were shouting at me, Anna Soubry, Kay Burley, they were filming it, putting it on Facebook, leaving it up for a few hours, then taking it down, and then using that attention as a call out for donations on Patreon, PayPal, etc. That's been taken down now, but it's precisely what the alt-right have been doing in America. So I think it is... policing at the moment, and I think it's looking precisely at who they're targeting and the tactics they're using. And it seems like Facebook and PayPal have moved a lot more quickly than the police initially did.
And it's a broader, it's tempting, isn't it, to say this is something that Brexit has done to our political life or to the tone of debate or whatever else. But it, as you say, it's akin to something that's happened in the States, and it's something about the tone of political discourse or
yeah.
something, isn't it?
What's behind it? Well, there has definitely been a coarsening of the discourse. It's partly social media, where people have got used to, taboos have been broken, where people are abusive to each other in a direct face-to-face way that you can't really find precedent for on this scale. You know, if you look 5-10 years ago, just political conversation just wasn't conducted like that. Social media definitely did change it. I think Brexit did unleash something. I mean, the vitriol, the visceral nature of the argument. There's something about, again, that binary dispute. And because, the earliest precedent for it was actually the Scottish referendum. You know, we saw those scenes where Jim Murphy basically couldn't move around when he was leading Scottish Labour. There is something about that that puts people into these camps. And you would say, well, party system always did that. You would be in two parties. The nature of those parties was they were always coalitions, and they forced compromise within, because you'd have people who really disagreed with each other who would have to be on the same side. Something about just separating it down to one issue does, I think, it's hard to, you'd almost have to get a psychologist to explain why that is, but it does seem to make things more polarised, or perhaps by
definition. And that's sort of bound up with personal identity in some ways.
Somehow it becomes that you are, this is who you are, that, the fact that Anna Soubry is a Remainer so incensed those people who were harassing her, really, that they felt able to call her a Nazi. I mean, there's no ideological coherence to it. It doesn't make any sense. But something about the fury this unleashes. And, it deeply troubles me, because what happens is each time there's something like this, another taboo is broken, another boundary is broken, and it does feel as if the sort of constraints we have, the kind of guardrails that shaped our public conversation, often which we pushed against and sort of mocked, these conventions of courtesy or whatever, by breaking them down all the time, who knows what we are paving the way for? in terms of a breakdown of our kind of civic space. So, you know, I don't take it lightly at all. I think in this case, by the way, it wasn't complicated for the police. They're trying to turn it into a free speech issue. Harassment is harassment. Just barking and shouting and sort of jostling someone in the street is not allowed. It doesn't matter what they're saying. You know, people have tried to think it's about the word Nazi and how it was used, if that's going to be illegal. The point was the harassment of her and others as they were in Westminster.
Yeah, stopping them going about their daily life.
And why is this complicated? It's one of the most policed areas in the country, if not the most policed, around Parliament Square. So I'm at a loss to understand. You know, and our colleague Marina Hyde had great fun tweeting, mocking this note that came out from the Metropolitan Police, that they had advised police officers that if they see or hear a crime being committed, they should step in.
Excellent advice.
And, you know, Marina tweeted saying, you know, shock, as in police briefing rooms around the country, as their whole world is turned upside down. You know, they're meant to know that already, and they're meant to act on that. So it's shocking that this needs to be said, but it does.
And will both major parties are somehow trying to contain these sort of deep, you know, but both Labour and the Tories have people who feel, you know, not on the kind of nasty scale that we're talking about, but have people who feel very strongly on both sides of this Brexit divide, don't they? It's quite hard to contain, isn't it?
It is. Unfortunately, I think the political class needs to reflect a little bit on its own actions over the last few years, because I think it has become commonplace in our politics to target the man or woman rather than the idea. If you think back to 2014, whenever it was, when David Cameron was reported as calling people on the right of the Conservative Party swivel eyed loons, if you think about John McDonnell talking about taking direct action against people rather than about ideas, I think there is a responsibility of those people in politics to act in the way in which we want constituents and voters to act, with politeness, with a sense of duty and respect. And that's been slightly lacking, and it's actually been flowing out of our politics rather than flowing in the last few years. So I would just argue all politicians of any party, and I think this isn't something you can blame at any particular one party, I don't think, to lead by example rather than to respond in kind, because there is a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy about all of this, that the people target Anna because she's a Remainer. Anna therefore reacts as I can completely understand why she does, and people cluster around her and respond in kind, and then it becomes ever more coarse rather than taking the high ground and helping the kind of problem at heart be solved.
Okay, I'm afraid that's all we have time for. My thanks to all my guests, Will Tanner, Jonathan Friedland, Dawn Foster and Dennis Campbell. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Heather Stewart. Politics Weekly will be back next week. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.